Tonight on Arena. Dark thrills, darker comedy, and long-awaited reboot in TV, and new albums from Mitski, Buck Meek, and Gorillaz. Friday night, welcome along to Arena. We are going to sort out your pop culture needs for the weekend. Text us on 51551. You can WhatsApp 0870 32 32 32 or email arena@rte.ie. We start as always with TV. First up tonight on Sky and Now, the darkly comic thriller DTF St. Louis. It is the series that follows two suburban men played by Jason Bateman and David Harbour who turn to a no-strings-attached dating app in an attempt to shake up their failing marriages. But when a sudden death upends their plans, they're pulled into an unexpected murder mystery. Over on Prime, we're in France for their new thriller Vanished. It follows Alice Munro, played by Kaley Cuoco, who's on a romantic trip to Paris to meet her boyfriend Tom, played by Sam Claflin. Things take a dark turn when he disappears on a train, and Alice's subsequent search for him takes her across the country, discovering secrets which shatter everything she thought she knew about him. And finally, a comedy reboot from Disney with the return of the beloved medical comedy Scrubs. It ran from 2001 to 2010. It's still running somewhere right now at this moment as I speak. It includes many of the original cast, including Zach Braff, Donald Faison and Sarah Chalk, reprising their roles as J.D., Turk and Elliot. And in this reboot, the one-time interns are in Sacred Heart as senior doctors who are now mentoring a brand new group. Jen Gannon and Chris Wasser have been busy binge-watching all three and they join me now. We're going to start with DTF St. Louis. It's on Sky and Now. Two middle-aged men, Jason Bateman and David Harbour, both stuck in unhappy marriages. They join a no-strings dating app specifically for married people seeking affairs. Chris, what could possibly go wrong?
What could possibly go right, Rick? We probably can't say what DTF stands for, and that's all right. You'll find out quick enough when you actually watch this show. But it's Clark Forrest, a weatherman in St. Louis, played by Jason Bateman, who is the first to kick up a conversation about this new dating app that's called DTF St. Louis. It's an app that is designed for married couples looking for strangers to help, quote, spice up their sex lives. And Clark, who's this famous weatherman in the area with his face on every second billboard all across town, he tells Floyd, played by David Harbour, who's a sign language interpreter who works on David's weather bulletin sometimes, about this app, because the two of them at the beginning of this series, which is structurally a little bit discombobulated, we'll come back to that, the two of them are forming this friendship. They seem to be bonding over the fact that they're both a little bit stuck in their lives. On the outside looking in, it looks as if they have everything. They've got, you know, it looks like they have a happy marriage, they get on well with their kids, they have this great job, but really they're both struggling to connect with those kids. Specifically, Floyd is struggling to connect with his stepson, his sex life with his wife Carol, played by Linda Cardellini, it's non-existent. The same goes for Jason Bateman's character Clark, who himself and his wife, their relationship, because of the hours that he works, you know, he does like the 5 a.m. weather, they're just passing ships, and they sort of regard one another as roommates rather than partners. So they both, it seems as if they're encouraging each other to sign up to this app, and we think this is what the series is going to be about. There are hints there of maybe a possible affair between Clark and Carol, and then all of a sudden it shifts. And I should say this is not a spoiler whatsoever. The entire show hangs on the fact that we are shown in the first 15 minutes Floyd dead in a community swimming pool. Something has gone terribly wrong and someone is going to be blamed on his death, that it possibly wasn't accidental. So what happens is that it turns into this big murder mystery about a potential love triangle. We're following the 8 weeks leading up to Floyd's death, but we're also following two different detectives, one of them played by Joy Sunday, the other one played by Richard Jenkins, as they try to figure out what the heck is DTF St. Louis and what the heck happened here.
Jen, it sounds like there's a lot going on here.
There is a lot going on here. And if you remember, cast your mind back to November when we were talking about Stranger Things, and you said to Chris, was David Harbour's, with Lily Allen's album about David Harbour and the breakup of their relationship, West End Girl, would that affect the way he saw Hopper or the way that he acted?
I
would it change
that.
His mind about David Harbour?
Yeah.
What a show that has now arrived at our doorstep. And it's no wonder, I think, that David Harbour has opted out of doing any press around the show, because the show itself, as Chris has said, is about those clandestine relationships, those apps that people go on when they are happily, quote unquote, married and try and find somebody else. So I think that is going to pique a lot of people's interest in the show itself. But it is, there is a lot going on, and the way it's actually the story unfurls is very different as well, because it flips back and forth. So you're never seeing the first scene you'll see is actually maybe happens a couple of weeks, a couple of months into Floyd and Clark's relationship. So it's all out of order, and it's up to yourself to navigate that. So you're getting to know these people when they've established a relationship, and then you're going backwards to see how that relationship transpired, what were the motivations maybe behind that, because you do think perhaps Clark is getting Floyd involved in this because of the guilt that he feels about starting up this affair with Floyd's wife, Carol. And is that the genesis of why they end up on DTF St. Louis? Is that how this happens? And then also you see these characters alone, their own hang-ups about themselves and how they all interact with each other. And then also you have the crime element of it thrown on top. So this is Stephen Conrad's It's Sad Suburbanites in Status tale. It kind of reminded me of, if anybody's read like Rick Moody's short stories, kind of like that. It's has this very late 90s ideal to me. It reminded me of Alan Ball's American Beauty, the ennui of the happily married man living in suburbia. And I just don't know if right now audiences, especially female audiences, are that fascinated by the neurosis of middle-aged men and their sex lives and their hang-ups as they once were, or once were thought to be, if I'm honest.
Great. Let's take something from it. This is Jason Bateman as Clark explaining the concept of DTF St. Louis and the app to David Harbour's Floyd. And yes, there is a word strategically bleeped out.
You meet these people, married people. It's mostly for married people, the reporter was saying, who are very happy and they want to stay in their healthy marriages. But they're also down to like people that they've never met before. In St. Louis. So you can spice it without, you know, creating commitments or...
Spice what?
Spice your life. Spice it up.
Chris, it sounds like unless you get a structure like that very, very right, it could end up being an awful lot of hard work for you as the viewer.
It is hard work for us as the viewer. I mean, the very first episode, which is about an hour long and some of them are a little bit shorter, feels like one big long trailer to kind of give you an idea of what the rest of the series is going to be like. It's like, this is happening now. This was actually 6 weeks ago. This is 8 weeks in the future. Now we're just going to shift focus to the detectives. And then, oh yeah, we might come back to Floyd and Clark and then even Carol at some point.
Do you need a board with strings on it?
Oh yeah, you really do. Yeah. I mean, we sit here so often and we give out about, you know, starting at the end and then coming back in. This one just goes all over the place, sideways, back and forth. So that can be a little bit frustrating. It sometimes feels as though two different shows are competing for our attention here. You know, this very sarky, icy detective thriller with Richard Jenkins. Very good here. There isn't a bad performance in this series. Yeah. But the stuff then with Floyd and Clark, sorry, that could have been a show in itself. There were times where I was even thinking to myself, the murder bit is probably the least interesting part. Every time we go back to the police investigation, I won't say who's charged or who's suspected of doing something wrong here, but every time we go back to Richard Jenkins' side of things, despite the fact that he is a joy to be around, I just wasn't really interested in the case. It feels like Stephen Conrad, he started off with something true here. He started off with a true crime series. This series has been in development for 4 or 5 years. It was originally inspired by a New Yorker piece entitled My Dentist's Murder Trial, Adultery, False Identities, and a Lethal Sedation. And on the back of that one magazine article, which was based on something very bizarre, even more bizarre than what actually happens here, Pedro Pascal and David Harbour signed on. Now, at some point, Pascal exited the building, Harbour stayed involved, and Conrad decided to completely change the story so that all of the truth was taken out of it. It's just completely original and fictional, and Jason Bateman was brought in. And I don't know why they've decided to put everything out of order. Basically, Rick, this feels like a show that should be so straightforward, but is going out of its way to be complicated.
Yeah.
Jen, in terms of the roles for women here, are they underwritten? Are they given enough time and space? How does that work?
From what I've seen, I mean, I think, look, I'm a fan of Linda Cardellini's work from the days of Freaks and Geeks to Mad Men, but I feel that her character, Carol, is being underserved as this strange, sexy enigma, because this is a very much a Men in Crisis series. And I wanted later episodes, hopefully, will open her out a bit, because right at this moment, she's just this very frustrated housewife who bears this uncanny resemblance to Cheryl Cole. I've got to say, I think it's the fringe. I don't know. It's really throwing me. But the thing about this is, there are great character studies here. Like, we're always crying out week after week for something which is more in depth. And I think with David, funnily enough, David Harbour actually shines. I mean, maybe it was the role he was born to play, who knows, as Floyd. He is this lovable sad sack who is living on the peripheries of his own life and feels very insecure and has all this love to give but doesn't know where to exactly put it, and he's putting it in the wrong places with the wrong people. And there's a sorrow about him that felt really believable, and I enjoyed watching that. I think Bateman is different. He's icy. There's a strangeness to, he's a very strange presence. He's a very specific type of health conscious environmental nerd. It reminded me of the way the Simpsons used to show Ed Begley Jr. Like, he traverses around St. Louis in this recumbent bike, and it probably is powered through his own sense of self-satisfaction. Like, there's an ease to his life that Floyd doesn't have, but there's also this innate blankness to him that kind of makes him a little bit strange, kind of scary on the edge of, you feel, yeah, he's always on the edge of a nervous breakdown. But okay, like, it's done in this, and I would love all of this because this all sounds great, but I think the style of it, it's very removed, it's very cold, it's highly stylized. Sometimes I felt like it was going out of its way to be offbeat. There's parts where Floyd is saying he doesn't want to have sex with Carol because he keeps on thinking of better in this ludicrously boxy umpire's uniform that she has to wear when she's, you know, being an umpire for her kids or whatever. And then there's, you know, the dependence that Clark has on this go-getter drink from Jamba Juice. Like, it's this self-conscious quirkiness that seems like it was built on a writer's room spidergram of what is odd, you know? And that is, to me, it's like an Alexander Payne, it's like an early Noah Baumbach, but it lacks that soul or the residual warmth that either of those directors have. So it was a struggle for me sometimes to actually get into it.
Okay, give me some stars then, please.
I think that I love Richard Jenkins, and as talented as he is, I didn't care about the events of the murder or trying to solve the murder as much as the goings on in that nucleus of the central characters. And I really hate how our midlife breakdowns have to repeatedly be served with a side of murder. We don't need this. It's not The White Lotus. It's not Big Little Lies. And it doesn't have to be. I do want to understand the certain flavour of miserable that's going on with these people. So I want to keep going with it. So I'll give it 3.5.
Okay, Chris.
I agree. I think if you remove the murder stuff, you could be onto a winner here. There's not a bad performance, as I say. I love the fact that Jason Bateman, he's this weird cross between, as you say, like Ned Flanders and Stephen King. And I would watch that all day. David Harbour is probably the best he's been in a long time here. And then the Cardellini, I mean, she just really has to just stand in the room with these performances, and she's probably better than them. There is something here that I'm definitely going to come back to, but I don't know if other viewers will, because I mean, the episodes are about an hour long. That's an awful, it's an awful long time to wait for something really exciting to happen. So I'm going to go with 2.5 out of 5. I will go back to it, but I'm not optimistic.
Okay. Next up, Prime Video brings us another thriller. This is called Vanished, in which Alice, played by Kaley Cuoco, is desperately searching for her boyfriend, Tom, Sam Claflin, who's disappeared on a train journey across France. Jen, we start with another exciting opening, followed by a flashback. So tell us more.
Flashbacks. Like, I mean, at the beginning of this, I thought, oh, is this going to try to be another Killing Eve? Like, in so many shows try to be Killing Eve. Why not? The first season, let me just say. And I like Hayley Cuoco. I think she's very sparky. She has this charisma on screen that I really enjoyed the first season of The Flight Attendant. And Vanished just feels like it belongs in, like, it's like a ITV drama from 1991 that would have starred Amanda Burton and probably would have been so much better for it if it was, in a way. So Cuoco plays Alice. She's an archaeologist who has this long distance country hopping relationship with Jordan based NGO Tom, played by Sam Claflin, who is like the most perfect man in the world. They're disgustingly in love. They rendezvous in Paris, and Tom says to her in Paris that he's booked this hotel that she's always wanted to stay in Arles. She finds this word scribbled on a piece of paper by him in their hotel room. She looks it up. It's a jewellery website. She thinks this is it. They're going to get married. It's a proposal. And that will dovetail nicely with her being offered this job at Princeton. They're finally going to settle down. That's until Tom seemingly just goes missing off the train, and it leaves Alice frantic. So she disembarks in Marseille and throws herself into searching for him. And she's not really helped by the local police. They don't really care. The investigating officer, Drax, basically says in this very French way, Tom's just been an awful boyfriend who was grown tired of her and just did a legger. And she gets the feeling that, you know, herself as she starts to begin to unravel this mystery that maybe she's not the only one that has been treated to some hotel trysts with Tom.
Okay, this is from an earlier point in the first episode. She meets up with Tom for the first time at a hotel in Paris, and over dinner, she has some news to share with him. This is Kaylee Cuoco and Sam Claflin.
Well, I have some news. I got offered a teaching position. Associate Professor of Archaeology. Princeton.
Oh my God, Alice. I mean, that's amazing.
Yeah.
That's exactly what you wanted. I'm so proud of you.
So? I'm going to have an apartment, you know, place on campus from which you and I could live together. I know it's going to be hard to leave all the dysentery. I totally understand.
No. That is big.
Big.
No.
Well, for a man with an English literature degree, you really have a way with words.
No, I know. It's a skill.
We've talked about this before.
We have.
Listen, I love that we get to meet up in hotels all over the world and that we actually want to have sex with each other all the time. But I want this job.
I'm not sure how anybody watching that gets over that moment of just watching them do that and go, well, we hate you, we're turning off this. It's done. Okay, so do we buy them as a couple, first of all, Chris?
Not really, no. I didn't get any sort of chemistry between them. Maybe it's because, at least for the first three episodes, and there are only four episodes, Sam Claflin and Kaylee Cuoco, they don't actually get to spend much time together. And then maybe that could be intentional too, because, you know, they are supposed to be this long-distance couple that only see each other every few months, but I just wasn't buying it. I actually started to ask myself halfway through the series, was this originally designed as a film, because the episodes are about 45 minutes long, not too long, Rick, that's grand. And I just thought the way the cliffhangers at the end of each installment, if you remove all the relentless throwbacks, the silly exposition, the clumsy establishing shots, very clumsy, you could actually end up with something, you know, a half decent 2-hour thriller, something that, you know, almost like Jen was saying, that could have been put out in the 90s and that might have done well. But instead, it's been stretched beyond silliness. And it's, I don't think, This is a bad series, and I don't think it's Kaylee's fault, and I don't think it's Sam's fault. I think it's the people managing it. I think it's very poorly managed. It's actually directed by a guy named Barnaby Thompson, and he made his name producing and directing comedies all throughout the 90s and early noughties. And this is not a comedy. It's far too square. It's far too po-faced. It's nowhere near as fun as the premise suggests. Because, I mean, this idea of this archaeologist losing her boyfriend on a train in Paris should be fun. You know, I immediately thought, okay, we are in flight attendant territory here. This is going to be a bit of a laugh, but it's not. In fact, some of the material here is just delivered with this bizarre sincerity where you don't really know how you're supposed to respond to things. I mean, at one stage, like Kaylee Cuoco's character, Alice, she befriends this journalist who is the most cartoonish journalist you've ever come across. She carries around a bolt cutter in her bag. And when she pulls it out, when they step onto a boat to break into this yacht, Kaylee looks at her and says, why do you have this? All good journalists have a bolt cutter. And I'm thinking, this, it's not played for laughs at all. So it's tonally awkward. It's, you know, as a result of some very bad writing, very badly performed. The action sequences are quite clunky. And the score sounds a little bit like it was, you know, produced for, again, a show from 30 years ago, and someone just came up with it now and said, will this do? In fact, there's an air of will this do about this show, and it just won't.
Okay, how many stars does Will This Do get?
I'm looking forward to seeing another Kaylee Cuoco murder show at some point. I mean, she has so many of them at this stage, so good luck to her, good luck to Sam. They're always quite likeable and watchable. Not here, it's 2 stars.
Okay. Jen.
What is played for laughs is there's a bizarre moment where Sam Claflin does an impression of Christoph Waltz for no reason.
Oh, yes.
And I would have pushed him off that train for that impression alone, which is very unfunny. I mean, as it goes, it's a fine plot, and I probably would have been more passable if it just wasn't so generic and so clunky. And I really feel that Kaylee Cuoco deserves better. And I think with The Flight Attendant, there was a great backstory with Cassie. You're invested in her struggles, her disappointments in life. And she was this leading character that came undone, and you wanted to know more about her. These characters are completely 2D. They're completely generic. And she tries her best to invest something into Alice, but there's absolutely nothing there. It's all extremely silly. And then when you go further into the mystery about Tom and his life, it feels way too serious for the frothy show we've been watching previously. So it would have been a tidy fun thriller, but it's so formulaic and extremely soulless that there's just not much enjoyment to be had here. So a two.
Okay, let's try and find some enjoyment in our final show this week. We are leaving the thrillers behind for a return to one of the most successful comedies of the 21st century. Scrubs is back at the Sacred Heart. This time, J.D. Turk and Elliot, played by Zach Braff, Donald Faison and Sarah Chalke, are all senior medics who are mentoring interns. Chris, where does new Scrubs begin in terms of where the old one ended?
Yeah, so Scrubs should have and was supposed to end after its eighth season in 2009, but the makers got a little bit greedy and they launched this ninth season, which was sort of this quasi spin-off that featured some of the older characters, but mostly focused on interns, and it really didn't work. It was quite joyless and jokeless, and as a result, it just lasted for one season. The going into this revival, which is, I think, maybe a result of the enthusiasm and also the continued friendship of the cast, the fact that Bill Lawrence, the creator, has had such a success over the last few years with Ted Lasso and Shrinking. There's a sense that everyone involved kind of wants to just see, check in on JD and check in on Turk and Carla and all the rest of them. And where are they and what are they doing? So what they've decided to do is, okay, we're going to delete that ninth season, that quasi spin-off that I mentioned. JD left Sacred Heart Teaching Hospital at the end of the eighth season. They were all going on to do, you know, big things in their careers. What have the intervening years been like for them? So that's what we're doing at the beginning of this new revival, where we've got the bulk of the original cast returning to train new interns. And it's been a decade and a half since JD, played by Zach Braff, left Sacred Heart. He's now working as a concierge doctor. He's working in the suburbs, making house calls to rich patients. Not the future you basically planned for this guy or that you expected of JD. You always thought he was going to do something special. But he's pulled back to Sacred Heart when one of his patients has an accident, ends up in that hospital, and he has to go in and check on them. And while he's there, he's sort of tricked by his old mentor, Dr. Perry Cox, played very well by John C. McGinley, into sticking around, because as it turns out, Perry wants to retire. And he thinks that the world has passed him by, and that he no longer has the patience or the resilience to, you know, he thinks that the interns that he has now are unteachable, or at least he can't teach them, you know, but he thinks that JD has the sensitivity and, you know, the wisdom to pass on to a new generation. And also he'll be able to be surrounded by his old pals again.
Okay, this is when JD returns to Sacred Heart to visit that patient of his private practice. He's arguing with an intern, Dr. Park, about her diagnosis, and then gets confronted by his former boss, Dr. Perry Cox, at the very end. This is Zach Braff, John C. McGinley, and Joel Kim Booster.
There's my gal.
Oh, goodness, Jonathan. They've got teenagers working here.
Those are just interns, Mrs. Brooks. Okay, your labs look fine. I think you're just dehydrated. Who admitted you?
I did.
Oh, can I ask why? No judgment.
None taken. I admitted her because I'm a good doctor.
Oh, Dr. Park. Is it?
When doctors fight in front of a patient, they always try to make it sound friendly.
These labs are normal for a woman of her age. If it helps, I could explain to you what all these fancy numbers mean.
It's so nice to meet an incredibly stupid person. Her abdominal pain suggests ischemic bowel.
No, all she needs is hydration and emollient laxatives.
And there he was, the chief of medicine, my mentor. At least he couldn't call me newbie anymore.
What can I do for you there, oldie?
Damn it.
All right, Jen, how do you feel about this, about the characters, about where they are, about them being played by the same actors, and about where they are in their lives?
Yeah, I mean, look, I was never a Scrubs. I mean, I don't know if anybody's chomping at the bit to go, oh, like, Scrubs, when is it going to come back from war? Like, it's not like announcing, you know, Sugar Ray are having a reunion. Like, Scrubs always was on in the background. It was always something that was on the background when you're trying to buy a polyphonic ringtone for a fiver. Like, it's real that time. It's nostalgia is such a big business. This is very much the do you remember Fat Frogs level of anti-anxiety comfort telly for millennials. It's like hooking you up to an IV drip of Capri Sun, like, for our parched souls. And I get that, and I get the joy people get out of that, and everyone is fine. It feels like you're just throwing yourself back into those episodes. They're not reinventing the wheel in that way, and I think that's a really good idea to do that. Everything is exactly the same, but it's new Scrubs but it's also exactly the same scrubs. So you do have these new faces alongside the old guard. And I think, it, you know, they do manage to pull that off more successfully than something like And Just Like That, because given the fact that you're working in a hospital, so new doctors and new interns are going to be around. And but the problems I kind of have with it are the usual problems that we have when you bring these things, these kind of shows back. It's like, oh, we're fighting against woke guys. You know, you can't say anything these days. So you have comedy stalwart Vanessa Beyer. She plays Sibby, who's this mental health HR, I guess. And basically, she's just your general wet blanket woke scold. So she's going around restricting some of the old behaviours, you know, Todd sexism, Cox's abuse, JD being JD. So, and that's one of the big themes of Scrubs 2.0. It's just the presence of Sibby, this humorless symbol, this encroachment on the carefree antics of the early 2000s. But the thing is, don't worry, folks, she's just one administrator that won't get in the way of all our laddie hijinks. And that's fine, but I just, I actually liked the stories of some of the new cast better than I did some of the old cast, because I think that there's good people there. I mean, there's some people that are forgettable, don't get me wrong. I didn't really like Dr. Tosh, like, that everybody makes fun of because she's a TikTok doctor. Who cares? But like, there's some good stuff with the surgical interns, I think, Dashana and Amara. And I wanted them. They were the most interesting dynamic to me comedically, and their setups are good. I wanted them to be set up to be the Turk and JD of the next generation, and I hope that's what they do and lean into their unlikely friendship. And I think it's got enough there to satisfy you watching it maybe as old friends, seeing your old friends, but have these newcomers as well. But it needs more of that, I think.
I have this conversation quite a lot about there being this dearth of TV shows out there that are about 22, 23, 24, 5, 25 minutes that are funny, that I need to fill 30 minutes in my life. This seemed to be a lot more like that for me and for you, as I understand it.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. And I think I might be the opposite of Jen in that every time, I think the interns are a necessary evil. They're integral to this Brave New World landscape at Sacred Heart and also in the world. But I just found them quite whiny and one-dimensional. It was like, oh, here's the British intern and here's the arrogant intern and here's the one who was homeschooled, so therefore they're weird. It just felt like every time the interns were on, I was asking myself, where are JD and Turk? And when they come in, the cogs turn so effectively, so smoothly. And there's this wonderful chemistry between Faison and Zach Braff, because they are best buds in real life and have been for 25 years. So they have this just natural charisma together. You can tell that they are enjoying themselves so much. And I think the balance has been readjusted with Scrubs, because during those last few seasons, it just embraced the goofier elements a bit too much. It floated a bit too far from the ground. It spent more time in JD's head because, of course, you know, those famous daydreams that he has, than it did in the actual hospital. Here, it's about doctors again. It's about doctors who have all of a sudden realised, oh, wow, we're up against Father Time here. Oh, wow, we're up against a crooked healthcare system. And, oh, wow, we're all burnt out. Everybody is. And those elements I really liked. I love
they don't shy away from that at all.
They really don't shy away from that. That always felt like it was kind of in the background in the original Scrubs. This time around, it's like, we love our jobs, but, you know, how are we supposed to work in these conditions with the, you know, with these funds? But also the funny side of things, it is genuinely funny. Scrubs was never the funniest show on television. It was never the coolest show on television, and it was never going to win awards. But there was always something quite cozy about it that you could tune in, as you say, for 20 minutes and get a good laugh out of it. And that, unlike, say, Ted Lasso and Shrinking, where you do enjoy it, but you kind of hate yourself a little bit for enjoying it because you've been tricked into feeling something. This time around, you do come away after those 22 minutes and go, that was lovely. And it's so rare to come away from a revival like this, a sitcom revival, and not be, you know, embarrassed on behalf of the people involved. I had a great time with it.
Tricked into feeling something. How awful. We're going to finish up Stars, please, Chris.
Yeah, I'd watch another few seasons of JD and Turk. I do want to see a lot more of Dr. Cox. He is a special guest star at the beginning. Mm-hmm. But we have been, the creator, Bill Lawrence, actually took to social media there yesterday when the show launched and said in a very cryptic message, yes, there will be more of them, so I will stay with this. 4 stars.
Okay, Jen.
I guess, like, I always have a Bill Lawrence problem because I find him too gentle for me, but I think out of his stable, Scrubs is probably the one that offends me the least. I mean, it's the least treacly, it's got some good jokes, it zips along, it's seamless at this stage. So I mean, I'd give it, we were talking about the grand scale the last time I was here, but, and I think on the scale of grand, it's a grand, it's a big fat grand, so yeah. It's true.
DTF St. Louis is streaming on Sky now, Vanishes on Prime Video, and Scrubs is available on Disney+. Plus, Jen Gannon, Chris Wasser, thank you very much. You are listening to Friday Night's Arena, and we finish off this week's programme with the most interesting, most noteworthy, and even in one case, the most star-studded of the week's new album releases. They're the latest from Gorillaz, Damon Albarn's virtual band, along with animator Jamie Hewlett, and their new release, The Mountain. Also up for review is Nothing's About to Happen to Me by American singer-songwriter Mitski, and then to the latest solo album of Big Thief guitarist Buck Meek. His album is The Mirror. Joining me now to pick them all apart are Zara Hederman and Eamon Sweeney. We'll start with Gorillaz. Way, 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 way back in the last century, Damon Albarn crawled from the wreckage of Britpop and decided to do something completely different. So different, his new venture wouldn't even feature his boyish good looks and his England soccer top. Instead, he would be represented by an animated avatar. The band was Gorillaz. Fast forward to 2026, they are back with their ninth album called The Mountain. Zara, tell us about Gorillaz, but maybe about how unique they were at the time and how much the music world has caught up with them in the intervening years.
Yeah, it's kind of wild to think back in 1998 when they launched a virtual band. People kind of scoffed at that and wondered how it would work. And now, 9 albums, 30 years later, the charts have so many, like, you know, the K-pop Demon Hunters fake bands are like in the charts there. We also have AI artists being kind of pushed to the fore. So they're very like forward thinking with their kind of virtual, non-virtual mix of members. And then, as you said, like the mix from going from Britpop to then leaning into like more hip-hop, trip-hop, dub, electronic, and always bringing on such an interesting cast of collaborators. I did see somewhere, someone said over the 9 albums that there's been around like 100 guests on their albums. And in that, they've always been really interesting and like bringing this kind of apocalyptic party album, which is another description I saw that really kind of perfectly captures them. There's a bit of a doom to them, but you're always still a bit chair dancing, so you don't really know what kind of emotion to feel, but they are always a really good time and very kind of forward thinking in their productions.
Eamon, as I understand it, there was a very specific brief for this album.
Yes, a very, very ambitious and audacious brief of the challenge. According to Damon Albarn, the challenge we set ourselves was to make an album about death that made people feel less afraid of death. Now, this does not sound like stuff that you'd, you know, ripe for a great time on a Friday night, but there is something curiously uplifting and happy about this album. And it really centres from Damon lost his father, Keith, in 2024. He's a very colourful counterculture figure in his own right, managed the prog rock band Soft Machine. And he travelled to India, to Valencia, to scatter his ashes. He's always been this musical polyglot, just kind of taking influences from everywhere. You know, one of his first post-Blur projects was Mali Music. He's done Africa Express. And it comes as a little surprise that he soaked up all these Indian influences and has kind of threaded through this album. Lovely sitar sounds, one-string violins. It's very hard to describe. There is a sadness, but a weird happiness. Maybe summed up literally a song about being with his father on his deathbed, and it's called The Happy Prince. And I think that title really hints at this kind of, this lovely kind of bittersweet melancholy, but resilience that's kind of lurking beneath this album.
Okay, let's take a little bit from that. And that's The Sweet Prince, Gorillaz with AJ Prasanna, Johnny Mars on guitar there as well, and Anushka Shankar too. Zara, talk to me about the people on this album, because it's an unusual one in that he reincarnates an awful lot of singers and performers on this. He uses samples from previous performances from people who've now since passed. Like, walk me through that.
Yeah, and kind of as Eamon was saying earlier, like his father and Jamie Hewitt's father also died. So they were interested then, that inspired them to revisit some of the unreleased recordings they had made with the likes of Dennis Hopper, with Marquis Smith, with Tony Allen. And also they had said that they wanted to incorporate them along with living guests like Sparks, Paul Simon and Idols, Cara Jackson, as a way to kind of show that even when you die, you can still live and your spirit goes on. It's just a different kind of iteration of yourself. Now, when I did see this, I wondered how it would work. And I did think, you know, I saw Dennis Hopper was particularly interested in hearing him. And obviously he has such a distinct voice, like everyone recognises him. So he appears on the title track, the first track, and that for the most part is an instrumental song. It's a beautiful piece of music. But I always felt I was waiting and waiting for Dennis Hopper.
And as then, was I.
Yeah. And then he arrives kind of buried in the distance, yeah, very much like this kind of spiritual, ethereal figure, just saying the mountain for maybe 10 seconds and then yeah, we're on to the next song. Yeah. Kind of similarly with the Marquis Smith use. It's again a very fleeting, very brief use of it. And I just felt I didn't love that aspect to the album as well. Like that kind of melded with this album is 66 minute songs, 15 track song. That to me felt just a little bit of an indulgent choice.
We're going to take something from this again. Let's do this. It's The Empty Dream Machine. This has Black Thought on it, Johnny Marr and Anushka Shankar. They clock us in at night and check us out the next day. That's Gorillaz, Empty Dream Machine. So I suppose the question is, Eamon, there are an awful lot of different performers on this. There are dead collaborators, alive collaborators. There are different styles of music. Does it all come together as a coherent whole, or does that matter?
On the two times that I've seen them, Rick, they surprise me in, yes, it does. The last time was when they played Malahide Castle. The album out then was the Now Now. Maybe not quite as guest-laden as this, and more newbies at the time. That Little Sims, who became a star in her own right afterwards, really stole the show that day. I remember that very vividly. And kind of the first time they played in Dublin, they played behind a curtain in the Olympia. It was when they did a Trailblazer event at the Manchester International Festival for Demon Days, which was a remarkable show because they pulled pretty much every single guest on. It was very theatrical. Somebody would come on, and that could be everyone from Ike Turner to Martina Topley Bird to Sean Ryder, everybody bar Dennis Hopper. Interesting enough, he was alive at the time, but he kind of appeared via this voiceover. And I would imagine the tour for this, that's doing two nights in the Three Arena, and indeed the Tottenham Hotspur Arena in London, would be as many guests as they can, with a little bit of samples and voiceovers, kind of the ghosts of the past.
Okay.
As well.
Give me some stars on this then, please.
I really like a lot. Been listening to a lot, love it. But 4.5.
Okay, Sarah.
I'm going to go for a bit more of a conservative 3. I really liked it. There was just a lot going on. And I think it's one that really kind of demands a lot more time, a lot more attention. And for me, Anushka Shankar and Ajay Prasanna were just the stars of this album.
Okay. They are playing as well a night in the SSE in Belfast as well, just before they come to the Three Arena in Dublin. Now to something completely different, to Nothing Is About to Happen to Me. It is the new album by singer-songwriter Mitski, who is being seen by her very passionate fan base as a voice for the ages. Eamon, for people who don't know the name, who is Mitski?
Mitski is Mitski Maiyaki, known anonymously as Mitski. And she kind of kicked off her career around 2012. But from about 2020 on, it really kind of skyrocketed. Barack Obama, in he used to do these kind of, and I think he still does these kind of annual roundups of my favourite books and songs. He included her. She is the epitome of someone akin to how Swifties embrace Taylor Swift, has this absolutely fervent fan base who are completely obsessed with her. Obsessed and pore over every single lyric, every single look, and are obsessed with filming the show from start to end. And that has made her, quite rightly, a little bit uncomfortable with that. And she has kind of maybe a mixed relationship, she can, with this fan base. Her musically, extremely eclectic. And this one kind of veered, there's almost three different strands to it, kind of from a noisy guitar rock to this very, very middle of the road, very commercial vaudeville kind of musical carry on. And then these really, really kind of sad country-ish kind of strains to it. So yeah, a lot to unpack in a very short album.
Mm. Okay, let's take something from it. This is a track called Where Is My Phone? Mitski, Where Is My Phone? I think that's the first track I heard off this album. And you know, you're right, we're all sitting here nodding our heads. Zara, it's not necessarily representative of everything else on the album, though, is it?
No, if anything, this brought me back to like the earlier stuff, the kind of like Puberty 2, even Meet Me at Makeout Creek, or Bury Me at Makeout Creek, where it's a lot more lo-fi, it's a lot punchier, it's a lot rockier. Whereas I really love where she went to the more kind of 70s country, a lot of pedal steel in there with the last album, which we do get as well here. And that was my favourite mode of hearing her, because I feel her songwriting really lends quite well to having space and having kind of a bit of a softer, richer, lusher orchestration around her. In saying that, though, that is a very like invigorating song, and is one of the kind of, I found interesting, just moments where she's talking about the want of like disassociating and how her phone provides that kind of escape. Because as Eamon had talked about, her fan base have kind of really impacted her own mental health and her approach and her relationship with her career. And in that way, I always find she's quite an interesting artist, because she tells us what she wants us to hear in her songs, and she actually does so quite openly and frankly.
Okay, let's take something else from the album. This is a track called In a Lake.
'Cause anyone you can get close to smells like your first time around.
That's Mitski, In a Lake. You've seen her live, Zara. I did want to ask about that. What's that experience like being in the audience?
It was very interesting. I think it's one of the closest I've ever come to like Beatlemania. Like, it was just teenage girls like hysterically crying. Someone, I think, passed out. But like, it was fascinating to see. And just from even just like a stage production point of view, it was in Vicar Street, and she just had this incredible, very like fairy tale like setup, and she was very much part of the show. And like, she really puts everything into the show. So it was incredible to see. But then I think recently she played in the Three Arena, and I think it was a completely different story, where it was very stripped back. She had Richard Dawson open for her. So in that kind of way, she is able to kind of keep you on your toes of to what the live offering is going to be, as well as she does with her albums.
Okay. Eamon, is it an album you're going to find yourself coming back to?
I really don't think so. Some of it, I can appreciate some of the arrangements can be fantastic. She's a good guitarist, kind of an underrated guitarist, as we just heard. Some of it I found just so maudlin. It reminds me of the weather the last few weeks, and just being stuck on that kind of rainy afternoon. You can't go out, and you just, there's this weird claustrophobia to it. And I really, I'm certainly, as Zara's told you about the people kind of who go to her concerts, I'm certainly not her target audience whatsoever. And I have to be honest with you, a lot of this goes over my head about being the poet laureate of an anxious generation or so on. I just don't get it, I'm sorry.
Okay, and stars?
2.5.
Okay, Zara.
I liked some of the things I said. Eamon and I were talking beforehand, and I was saying how it just feels like she had three different ideas for three different albums and didn't want to sacrifice any of them, which made it a bit disjointed, which is a shame because there's some nice stuff on here. So it was a 3 for me.
Okay, we're going to take a break, and we're back after this with our final album of the week. Friday Night's Arena, we are reviewing the new albums this week, and we finish it with Buck Meek. He was the guitarist, and still is, and backing vocalist for Big Thief. This is his 4th solo album, though, as well. So tell us a little bit more about him, Zara. What do we know?
Yeah, so as you mentioned, guitarist in Big Thief, but also had like such a really interesting growing up of like playing music around like Texas and New York, playing in different like clubs with like jazz players, blues players. And one of my favourite Buck Meek accomplishments that he has achieved is Bob Dylan in 2021 had a concert film, Shadow Kingdom, and Buck Meek plays a guitarist in the band. I don't think he actually got to play the guitar in it, but he was there.
He's playing the
acting
role of a guitarist.
Yes. Okay. So incredibly cool achievement. But in that, like, he's had 4 solo albums, while Big Thief have also been a prospect. So like, while they're working and touring, he's still working away at his music. And reading about this album, I was really interested to see, like, he brought on a lot of his bandmates, like Adrian Lenker does vocals. The drummer, James Krifchenia, is the producer, but he also recorded it in his like home studio in LA, up in the mountains, a really intimate feeling, and recorded all of his vocals outside, which when you hear this album, it it's kind of mind-blowing to think that they were recorded outside up in the elements.
Okay, let's have a listen to some of those vocals. Then this is Buck Meek. The track is called Gasoline. Okay, recorded in the outdoors. Buck Meek, Gasoline. How would you describe the album, Eamon, and what did you make of it?
This kind of rustic rock and roll country. He's got a lyric that I think sums it up quite well of music is in my soul, rock and roll is in my blood. And as we've just heard on that track, the way that the words just seem to tumble out of his mouth. Outdoors, very raw. Is it country? Is it rock and roll? Slacker rock, new age, free jazz. There's all these little influences kind of bubbling underneath.
It's a lot of descriptions for one man.
Yeah. And I, you know, for somebody, you know, people might balk at this who wouldn't particularly be into Bob Dylan. I really kind of like where he's coming from. There's a nice kind of rawness to this that that I find very pleasant, very easy to listen to. And I'm slightly confused because the indie folk band Big Thief, pretty much three of them are on this record. Mm. So I'm kind of...
Why is this not a Big Thief
record? Exactly. Mm. I always wonder when these people write down a thing, going, am I going to write a solo album today? Or how do they, put in a compartment what the work they've just done anyway? But interesting fellow.
Does he stand out in a market of people who sound kind of sort of like this?
I mean, as much as lively and energetic as the song is that we heard there, I mean, not particularly. And that's like, I don't mean to be like diminishing of his work. What I do think he does stand out with on this album is lyrically, I think it's his strongest work. He's a lot more open and vulnerable and a lot more honest in like some of the stuff. I mean, as a critic, I had to kind of take a hard blow with Heart in the Mirror when he says, many years I've lived in fears of bullies and critics. Now I know the things they loathe is seeing them at their own fear in the mirror. So he's really taking jabs at the critics there. But like aside from that, he's also, it feels like, looking a lot more introspectively on himself and really picking himself apart, which I thought now with his fourth solo album, that's the aspect that I think is making me to kind of pay more attention to him, that his words are getting a bit stronger, a bit more human as well. So in that way, I'm going to listen to him for the week that I have to.
Okay, this is another track from the Buck Meek album. It's called Can I Mend It?
Oh, I threw me, saw it in my eyes. Can I mend it?
And that's Buck Meek. The track is called Can I Mend It? Eamon, so your thoughts on the album as a whole, Stars, is it the sort of one you're going to find yourself listening to in 3 weeks' time?
Remains to be seen. I do think there's enough there that I like the pleasantness of it. Whether there's enough grit to it, I think it might be quite a not really a multi-dimensional kind of record that I'm going to return to and get lots more. So I'll go with 3 stars.
Okay, Zara, we were all tapping our feet to it, so yeah, it's definitely got something.
Yeah, and actually with this album as well, he did an interesting thing of melding that acoustic nature with some modular synths, which does kind of bring a nice glow and warmth to some of the tracks. Will I be listening to this next week? Probably one or two of the tracks. I don't know how quickly I'll reach to it, but it is, I do think, one of his strongest solo efforts.
Okay, we've been listening to Gorilla's album The Mountain tonight. Mitski's Nothing's About to Happen to Me, and that is the new solo album from Buck Meek called The Mirror. Zara Hederman and Eamon Sweeney, thank you very much for joining me tonight on Arena. That is it for Arena for this week as well. We're back on Monday night from 7. John O'Donnell is going to be talking about his new collection of short stories. Director Alice Winnicourt on her new film with Angelina Jolie that's playing at the Cork French Film Festival. And we talk to actor-playwright Caoimhe Farran about her work at the upcoming Front and Centre Festival that's happening in Derry. Have yourself a brilliant weekend. I'll talk to you Monday, and John Creedon is next.